Hi, I'm Joe.
And I'm Dave.
And we're the hosts of the Chasing Tomorrow podcast, where we bring you stories that delve into the science and spirit behind intriguing people doing extraordinary things. Performance Tea has been supporting the Chasing Tomorrow podcast since day one, and they've released a new electrolyte and adaptogen-powered sport mix called Endurance. The lemonade and iced tea flavor are delightful, and at 70 calories per scoop, the blend is easy on the gut. You can check it out at performancetea.com, and they have given us a discount code for any of our listeners to get 20% off their purchase. Just use CHASING20 at checkout.
Welcome to the Chasing Tomorrow podcast. This week, it's episode 71. This week, we have a real treat for you. And I just found out from Chris that he hasn't done an interview before this. But Chris, just last week, ended up being the assist, the second runner-up at Big Dog's Backyard Ultra. Some would argue that this was the biggest race of the year. Now, Chris ended up earning his spot by running 56 hours and then assisting Steve Slaby at the Capitol Backyard. But only last week, he ended up running a second best in the world ever by running 84 hours to assist Harvey Lewis to his win at Big Dog's Backyard Ultra. Myself, I personally ran 40 hours and I could not imagine running another 44 hours beyond where I personally stopped. So Chris Roberts, I can't wait to talk to this guy. He's a father of two, 7 years old and 4 years old. He's a simulation modeling engineer. We're probably going to get into that because the guy figured it out. And maybe that's modeling engineering to its core. Chris is from St. Louis. Welcome to the Chasing Tomorrow podcast, Chris.
Thanks a lot. Happy Chris, to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. A week ago, I think you were running around at this point in the woods. So pretty soon after. I usually start with a little bit of background, but before we do that, we will hit the background. But how do you feel like a week later? Well, it's not even a week. How are you feeling?
Yeah, I know. It's only been like half a week. I'm still, I don't know. I'm pretty sore. My knees, which were the problem, one knee in particular, it hurts. Like still hobbling, going up and down steps is rough. The muscles aren't bad, but yeah, just the knees are torn up and still got some like cloudy mental fog going on. Yeah. Just from all the lack of sleep. It's just sometimes I'm a little forgetful, like forget how I'm supposed to clean up dishes and stuff like that. So yeah.
Well, if you ever have any excuse to not do dishes, you could blame it on the cloud and nobody would argue with you.
Yeah, my wife's being as accommodating as possible, but it's probably going to end pretty soon.
Yeah, that patience will wane soon. Yeah. So we did want to check in on you. And we'll talk some more about sort of the pain and all of that as we go along. But, you know, we love sort of starting by getting to understand who we're talking to just a little bit more. And I have to imagine that there was a time, probably even pretty recent, where you would ever imagined running, you know, 84 loops of 4 miles plus and doing that with really no sleep and continuing on. So, but how did it start? Like, were you a runner growing up? Did you like sports? Is this something new to you? Tell us a little bit about your backstory.
I mean, I ran track and cross country in high school. And then I opted not to run in college. Just kind of did some of the recreational stuff. When I was a teenager, a couple times I ran like road marathons without training. I don't know why. It was a miserable experience every time. it's like you go out at like Boston pace for the first half marathon because you're like a fit teenager, and then the last half is a total disaster. That kind of thing. But other than that, yeah, just nothing fancy. I didn't run for a good number of years, and it's probably around the time my daughter was born in 2014 I started picking it back up a little bit, decided I wanted to see what the ultras were all about because I had, I had read about them for a number of years. I thought it was interesting. I always had the sense that I needed to like do well at a marathon to get to that next level of ultra marathons. But I hate road running and all that stuff, so I just never did it. But then I finally was like, all right, we're just who cares about the marathon? Let's just try and take the leap and see what happens. So,
what was your first ultra?
My first like official ultra marathon was the DC North Face back in like 2015. That was a 50 miler.
How did that go, Chris?
It was all right, you know, lots of leg spasms and stuff like that at the end, but it went as well as could be expected. So.
And so, you know, I was talking to your crew chief. You know, what was the crew chief's name again at Biggs?
Jack Grisky. Sure.
Jack, yeah, and Jack had a lot of interesting things to say about you, and you know, one of the things that he was mentioning is that you're always pretty even keel. You know, there's not a lot that exists down there. There's not a lot that exists up top, but you're always in this even space, and that's one of the things that I got to realize about you on the course as well too. You're always very meh. I'm okay. I'm not great. I'm not terrible. You know, during your first number of ultramarathons, did you kind of find that as well too? That you kind of fell into this groove and you could stay in a groove?
It didn't take too long for me to just get a good sense of how to approach ultra marathons and just kind of have that kind of smooth operation. I say that risk mitigation is a big part of all of my racing. I try and be as even keeled as possible across a variety of related topics for running, like whether it's nutrition or pacing and all that kind of stuff. Just try and be as kind of even keeled as possible, so that you're not the idea that you're mitigating risks to the extent possible, whether that's putting in good training, going out easy, much easier than you wanted to in a race, making sure you're really on top of nutrition and have that figured out ahead of time, contingency planning and all that stuff. So I think it all just kind of comes together with most of my racing, and to where I don't have really out of the park efforts where you see some people when they're racing and they're just like totally gassed, like gunning it, just killing themselves to get to the finish line. I never have that kind of stuff, but I also don't have these massive collapses where I'm just kind of walking it in for 20 miles and on the struggle bus. So it seems to work out.
Yeah. So I mean, of course, this is stuff that goes on for long periods of time. A 50 miler could be 12 hours longer, shorter. You get to the 100 milers, you're into the 20 to 30 hours. Of course, this is much longer. So I think, you're going to still go through ups and downs, right? Because they're never that simple. Did you sort of have a progression? You went from 50s to 100Ks to 100 milers to others. What was the progression for you?
No, so actually before I even ran my first ultra, that 50 miler, I had in mind a 100 miler that I wanted to run, the Grindstone 100 in Virginia. And like I sent in, and when registration was open for that 100 miler, like it requires, like a qualifier, which I obviously didn't have an ultra qualifier yet. So I emailed the race directors just trying to confirm, like, can I sign up for this yet? Do I need a qualifier before I sign up or just have one before I start the race? That was always the goal, was to immediately jump in to like the 100 mile scene. So between like April or so of 2015 was my first 50. And then by October, I'd run Grindstone.
Yeah, so those stepping stones to get to the 100 miler, that it was really quite quick for you. What really intrigued you about like 100 miles? Was it kind of that risk mitigation? Was it having a plan? And because these events, especially these mountain ultras, they end up taking 20, 30 hours. Was that it? Is you thought, hey, my skill set is lies with being able to figure my shit out? Was that
I didn't know if I was going to be any good at it, but I thought that like there's all these things you got to think about, there's all this stuff that you have to plan for, and it seemed to kind of tick some boxes off for me. It just made sense. It was something that I could wrap my head around kind of piece by piece, strategically tackle these different components of how to run these longer races, and then just in general being out in the mountains, being out in nature, just seemed awesome. I really wanted to just kind of go all in. You know, 100 milers have that mystique about them. So,
Yeah, I think most people think it's ridiculous. Like, oh, you're going to run 100 miles? That doesn't make any sense, you know, that people don't drive their cars that far. So did your training evolve? Like, were you putting in longer weeks of mileage? Did you have a pattern to your, you know, preparation?
At the start?
Yeah, like as you got into the hundreds.
I mean, it was just trying to get some mileage under my belt. Some of that confidence, like, you know, can I do a 30 miler? Can I do a 30 miler on back-to-back weeks? And that kind of stuff. But it was really just getting the minimum in that I could get in without risking kind of blowing up my body. So it was probably a fairly average training to get started, to get into that first 100. And then the next couple of years is more just kind of tinkering and trying to figure out what worked best for me, just getting into regular training that you know, more and more ultra athletes do.
You know, and so what does that look like now from back then? Have you noticed that, you know, your structural tolerance has gone well up, or it hasn't? So, you know, your tolerance when it comes to fueling, when it comes to your mental strategies, you know, what do you think is, you know, from where you were during your first 100 miler to where you are now? Because there's a lot of 100 milers that can't imagine doing what you just did. What is that curve, and what upon that curve is the biggest piece? Was it the fueling strategies that you end up having? Was it the mental strategies? And I've got my own theories while watching you, and I'll answer those later. But what do you think that is?
I think it's mentally is, I think, really the most important part. I know what my body can do, more or less. I know what it shouldn't be doing. And I just try and maintain a level that I think is in my wheelhouse. It's, you know, it's kind of like, you know, there's a high level of possibility that you're going to be able to achieve some mark in a race, but you're not going like to the top end of that level. You know, there's like a buffer in there where you're kind of holding back a little bit. And so just always mentally being aware of that, making sure I don't get too close to the edge. And again, it's just that risk mitigation component. Just always being at the forefront of my mind when it comes to running.
So I think, you know, we're going to have to sort of fast forward to backyard, because, you know, as I was telling Dave, actually, I watched John Stocker's film of his 81 loops, which you guys just beat. And they, you know, it was, you know, you have to sort of like backyards and ultras to watch it a bit. But, you know, but a lot of the theme that the director has touches on the same themes over and over again, you know, which is, it's really hard to run a race where there's no finish line. It's really easy to finish that race the minute you decide how many sort of laps you're going to do, or how many hours anything where you put the end in ends the race. I mean, just literally, I think we're hearing that more and more. And so it's interesting then, how does one train for this? Because like everything else, you're not going to just sort of go run tomorrow and then just stop. You're going to say, oh, I'll do a 10 miler tomorrow. Or Dave says, yeah, I'm going to do a 20 miler. So like the transition, because you've become very good at backyard, clearly with two really amazing efforts in a row, did you change any of your mindset, your training leading up to it? Like, what was going to happen so you could keep going?
Yeah, I don't know if it really changed my mindset. Again, I think part of it was just confidence. Last May, when the pandemic was kind of just getting up and running, I did my own like little personal backyard in my neighborhood. You know, just raised some money for charity, put in some, you know, do something with the training that I had been building up for. And I just did 100 miles. On my own, just had my own, you know, little setup in my driveway, and it was just, I was surprised at how easy it was, just kind of taking it out, having a nice easy flow with the pace. And, you know, after 24 hours, I didn't think I would have any sleep problems, and I didn't. My nutrition was fine, my legs felt fine, And so I kind of had that confidence where, you know, I just had that mental aspect of knowing I should be able to go a lot farther. And there's no reason not to expect that I can't do something much bigger. And so I carried that through into capital and just, you know, try to have that mindset, that open mindset of let's just keep going. And my goal wasn't to win capital, it was just to get a good enough number to presumably get into bigs. And, you know, so as long as I had the assist or some value that was large enough that it was, you know, high on the at-large list, I was comfortable with stopping.
Yeah. And that was super interesting, Chris, because I remember you telling me that story when we were running on the course. We were running, I don't know, we were running a daytime loop, and you were telling me about that. And in my head, I was thinking, yeah, this guy's full of it. You know, there's no way that you ran 56 hours, you know, with Steve, and you were like, well, let's get to a certain point and then let's, you know, because, you know, I couldn't imagine running for 56 hours and Steve, you know, to Steve's 57. And not desiring the win. And, you know, I thought, you know, if this is at all even true, okay, this is a really interesting mindset of a very interesting individual who's modeled something that works. And, you know, in the end, there you are with Harvey at, you know, a world's best 84 hours. And so, yeah, I was wrong because, yeah, you've somehow modeled that in your brain that, you know, you don't really seem to get caught up in any one time out there on the course. You don't really take yourself too seriously at any time. You're like, well, okay, I'm doing okay here. I'm not doing great. I'm not doing terrible, but I'm getting by. And so tell us a little bit more about that, because, you know, that capital experience with, so, you know, that, you know, let's go a little bit further into that story, because when you were running with Steve, tell our audience about the conversations you were having with Steve and you know, that you really, your goal was to not win that race, but it was to, you know, garnish enough hours, enough, you know, distance in order to get a spot at bigs. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. So again, I'm not the most competitive person in the world. I mean, it's not to say like if I'm in the middle of a race and someone's up ahead of me and I'm not going to want to chase them down. Sure, I take joy in doing that. Especially when you're feeling really good and someone else isn't, you just crush their spirits. But like that desire to have like the win above all else has never really been something for me. So with capital, yeah, Steve and I ran together alone for like 12, 14, 16 hours, something like that. It was just him and I. And yeah, I was, at some point I just started having conversations with him. I was like, all right, how are we going to end this? Like, how do we wrap this up? And he clearly just, he wanted to keep going. He had that drive and, you know, it was a good day for both of us when we were having those conversations. So it was kind of like special in the sense that you wanted it to keep going. And I could definitely tell from him, like, it, you know, you can't go without somebody else. So, you know, if I'm there and I'm feeling good, I should keep going. And I did for a while, but I really didn't want going forever. Luckily, there was like a period where I just straight up lost my mind. So I was feeling great. Steve and I were feeling great. We were just talking about how everything was amazing. We could go on forever, just run for, you know, a whole nother day. And then I hadn't slept in like a second and I screwed up my caffeine for 1 hour and I just went on this horrible caffeine roller coaster. It was hallucinating like crazy. Couldn't figure out where I was on the course that we'd been running on for 54 hours plus. I didn't recognize things. And so after a couple hours of struggling through that, I was like, all right, my legs are fine, but my brain just needs to stop. So,
you know, being a crew, Dave's said this 100 times to me in backyard and other races like this. He says, you know, it's all good till it isn't. And the thing that I was surprised, even though I've had those hallucinations because I was chuckling when I did the Tahoe 200, I, you know, like the world appeared before me for many hours and days on end. And I finally convinced myself there are no billboards in the mountains, you know, and there aren't houses. Like I had to actually literally convince myself of that. But well, anyway.
So with that, I would say that's the terrifying thing at the beginning for me, because I'd never really had hallucinations before. And so at Capital, I found myself not simply hallucinating, but also in my mind, trying to justify why those hallucinations might be real rather than recognizing that they're hallucinations and just moving on. And so that was the really kind of scary thing, is when your brain is so messed up, you're like, that makes sense. I need to figure out a story as to why that makes me real.
The technique that I figured out, I don't know, Dave, if you've ever tried this, is if you go past where the hallucination is and look back, it's never there. So what you see, and I don't know why that is, but like everything I would see in front of me was there for sure. But like on the second or third night when I was trying to get used to this whole thing, I would look back and then it wasn't there. And it would be like, oh, okay, that's a hallucination. Because otherwise, you're right, you get caught up in this world that's that does makes you make a bad turn. That's what happens, is because you're so distracted that you don't even the simplest stuff. But this thing that was interesting for me, especially, you know, Dave isn't really thrilled that he only finished 40 loops, but still a lot. You know, he looked perfect until that one. And then it's like that. Literally the same thing happened to Courtney and Maggie. You know, Courtney especially looked great, and then it's over. And so the question is, did you have any of those tough moments? And then, because I do think if there was a way Dave could have gotten through it, I think there was physical strength to go another 40. You know, I think he would have been with you guys. But you have that moment and it's like this, you know, chasm that you have to cross. Did you ever feel that?
So the one, it's not a moment, it was more like 8 hours.
It was a full work day.
It was like the third night. We're going in, and so we'd done at least 60 hours at that point, and a few hours into the night, just my knee had started hurting, and it quickly degraded to where I couldn't like step and bend. I couldn't run. I couldn't use my leg to run, and so I was trying to figure out like how the heck do I just get to morning. As I figured, I kind of had this goal where I wanted to time out of the race, which usually I'm just like, because I'm so, I don't know, just meh about running. Like I don't have that, you know, huge urge to just keep going and kill myself for a win or something. So I would have said, all right, you just quit when you're feeling bad. But this time I figured it was such a big stage. I wanted to give myself a little bit more credit and try and push through. And so that's what I did for 8 hours, just trying to figure out new ways to get down the road without running. And so I was doing power walking for a little bit until the knee hurt too much to power walk. And then I had to devise like a whole weird screwy like skipping system, like sideways skips. It was really messed up, but that worked. It just expelled a lot of energy. So once I figured out that it worked, that I could get to morning, I think I was still in the right headspace and mentally lucid enough to be able to execute it. But it was tough there for a few hours trying to figure out how I was going to overcome that physical problem. Because like I was just straight up limping out of the gates and I couldn't put pressure on my leg. And it would have been really easy to just kind of call it in.
Yeah, and Chris, I saw a video of you doing that limp walk. It looked like you had a peg leg, like there was nothing there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I talked to a lot of the runners who ended up, you know, like me, dropping and you know, a lot of runners in a format like this, you know, after a while they look for reasons. They're like, okay, I'm kind of done with this. And you look for reasons. You're like, oh, that's a reason right there. That's a reason why it would be good enough reason to quit. It'd be a good enough reason to time out or to, you know, in you walking with one leg, running with one leg, you know, that sheer pain that you don't want to put any more than 15% load into that leg, that wasn't enough for you to quit?
I guess not. I mean, because when I figured out that I could make the time doing it, and it was a lot of effort, the weird skip jump thing. Like I was sweating profusely, just burning through calories, the hardest work I'd done in a long time. But it didn't hurt. There was, as long as I was like mentally focused and I knew exactly how my leg needed to land and push off, and like I had everything in concert with my movements, mm-hmm. I could get through it without stabbing pains in my leg. So it was just like, all right, mm-hmm. you're doing some, it's just a different stride. So let's just get through it.
And then
maybe something will magically happen, or then I'm gonna, or maybe I'll time out on the trail, because I figured there's no way my knee would be able to get through the morning, the first hour on the trail. So
Chris, the way I'm envisioning your mind in this moment is, and tell me if I'm wrong, is overnight, you know, your leg is limping behind you like a zombie, and you're thinking, well, you know what, I'm gonna give myself more credit, it's a big stage, I'm gonna do my very best to get to the finish line of every hour. And if I don't, well, at least I tried my best. And then you do everything that you did necessary and you got there every hour after hour after hour. And if I'm going to put myself into your head for a second and be like, ah, shit. You know, like, you know, this was a great opportunity here. My leg is destroyed, but yet I'm still finishing the loops. So I have no excuse. So I have to continue. Is that where you, you're at?
That's where the next day went. It was definitely an off shit moment when my knee had gotten like taped up right around dawn, and it was just like, go out there and see what you can do. And I fell a couple times and it hurt like hell, but then it stopped hurting for some reason, and then I was like, crap, I've got to keep going. My body doesn't, you know, my body's hurting less than it did in the overnight, so I can't stop.
When you were doing this skipping approach, what was your time on the road? How long?
I mean, so I had gotten it down to like 57 minutes for a couple of those hours. I was just being very strategic about my energy loads, trying to get to the turn with about a minute and a half to go, and then before the half hour, and then come around, just trying to pace it really well, not overexert myself too much, but. There were some times when I almost kept up with Harvey, I think, on one of the miles. One of those where I was skipping at like an 11-minute mile, sideways skipping 11-minute miles. And then I looked down at my watch, was like, oh, that was too fast. Like, you're working too hard. So yeah, it can be done. It was a lot of extra strain. So
takes a lot of will.
Yeah. So you're working through this. People are dropping out as you go along. The group is starting to shrink a bit, right? And, you know, how did you feel about as people were dropping out? Was that like a bad, sad, happy?
In the overnight hours where I was struggling, I honestly couldn't tell you a single thing that happened aside from me focusing on trying to get that leg moving. I mean, just every single hour was get through it, throw down a couple hundred calories if I can, and repeat. I didn't know if people were dropping. I didn't know who was left until the end, when it was just Harvey and Teramichi. So.
Oh wow! So that's when you finally realized it was down to three of you. Otherwise, you're just moving as best you could. Yeah, in that 3 minutes or so that you had, you know, as a crew, you know, we're always think is interesting, you know, I've done other kinds of things like that, you know, you think, oh, I got a whole hour, you know, all this time, but it goes by quickly, excuse me, and you really want to make sure you're ready for whatever the athlete needs at that moment, because you don't know, oh, do you want something hot, do you want something cold, do you want something sweet, do you want something salty, do you want a drink, do you want, like, it's, and you don't have a lot of time, and there's no cushion. And then, you know, you're walking out of your tent and, oh, Dave, you forgot this, or, you know, and so, yeah, to be effective in that 3 minutes, because if you don't get any calories in or take something back out with you, you're not going to keep going. This is already ripping you in half. So,
yeah, I think we were at that point, I knew around 66 hours that the rest of the night was just going to be rough. 3 to 72 hours was going to be like this, cutting it close all the time. And I had had some acid reflux problems before, and I couldn't eat salty or like acidic foods, and it was just kind of ruining my gut, and my throat was feeling so weird from all that. So I think at that time we were probably just throwing a gel in my handheld and putting some sports drink in my handheld. And then maybe if I got to sit down for a minute, in those quick little interchanges, they were shoveling some rice down my mouth or, some noodles. I think at one point I came in like a panic and I was just like, we got to get some noodles or we got to get some rice or something. Like we got to figure this out because we hadn't really prepped for making hot food at all. That really wasn't part of the initial plan. But yeah.
I'm sure 84 wasn't part of the plan either, right? You never.
I don't know. I mean,
did you think it would go that far? Was that what you were before? Yeah. Like whether it was going to be you or not? Did you? Because Dave and I were talking a lot leading into this, right? That this was a crew of people who there was 100 hours in there somewhere, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I still believe there's 100 hours there. That's not gonna, it's going to happen pretty soon. It's just. Yeah, getting everything to fall into place. But yeah, I had I had this mindset that 72 hours was entirely doable. And I had this, you know, thought of 72 to 100 hours. That's a pretty wide range of possibilities of things feeling good or things feeling absolutely terrible. But I thought it could be doable.
Well, but Chris, let's talk a little bit about those landmarks and getting over those landmarks. So, okay, so you got through the night. The third night, and that's 72 hours. Now the Biggs course record is 68 hours, and some would argue that the world record matters, the 81 hours, but you know it wasn't really done on Biggs, and so the Biggs record, you know, it's Johans and Courtney, they both, you know, they both combined did that in two different years, was 68. So I want to ask you about three landmarks. You know, there's 68, so going on to 69. There's going beyond 72 into 73. And then there was, you know, John Stocker's record of 81 going on to 82. Were there any one of those landmarks you kind of, you focused on and then you felt relatively complete and complete enough to go, okay, I've gone over that mark. If I were to drop out now, I would be okay.
So I didn't even mentally process the 68, to be honest. I was in the middle of my own little skip jump hell. So at that point, my entire focus was get to daylight, get to 72 without even really like doing the math of 72 is greater than 68. But I think I didn't know what the record was, the world record of, was 81.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I knew it was like low 80s, but I didn't know exactly what it was. And kind of approaching that number, it was more just, I'm feeling good. I'm going to keep going. Mm-hmm. Whatever we're doing, there's, you know, there were three and then two of us that were still going. So, it looks like the record's probably going to fall. So, just keep on pushing through. Once we got past that, you know, there's the little bits of celebration at the line, especially with Laz ringing in the new records. I don't know if it was a sense of relief, but I definitely got that sense that if my knee screws, it just acts up again. I was afraid of what was going to happen on the roads. I knew I could at least be proud. we've gotten farther than anybody else. So,
you know, one of the things for people listening, we did talk about this with Dave, you know, there's four Biggs, there's a day course and a night course. There's the day courses in the woods, on the trail, and night courses on the road. You know, I got to run both of them. So I have a pretty good sense of what you guys are dealing with. And your knee aside and having to do the skip, hop, jump kind of thing on the road, did you prefer the trail over the road anyway?
Yeah, I hate the roads. The roads are just like mentally, they're mentally taxing for me. It's just, you can see for a whole mile down the road and you're just like, I have to get all the way through that. And it's just dark and boring and the same footfalls every single step. But I like trail running much more anyway. And I really enjoyed the trail. I liked the different components of the trail. It was new and exciting to me every single lap we ran it. So I honestly would have preferred if we ran the whole race on that trail.
Yeah, I think that, that's certainly headlamps. I mean, they do that lots of other races. They just stay on one course and you'll be doing it night and daytime.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, Chris, but with your leg, you know, the limp, you know, after the 72 hours, were you worried at all? Because there's a lot of sections on that course where, you know, I took a big wipeout in that kind of that rock kind of gully area, and ran right into a rock right in my shoulder. And, you know, like there were moments where I was thinking, okay, if you have a limp, if you can't, you know, propel or pick up your leg in the right way, that's you can get into trouble out there, because you have to veer left and right and jump and kind of bolt over certain landmarks. Were you worried about that on the 73rd loop?
Yeah, so I thought I was going to time out on the 73rd loop. I was 100% prepared to basically just walk jog it for 90 minutes or whatever it was going to take. I did not honestly think I was going to finish. I had no expectations of that. Struggling through the night was just to get to 73 so I can check out that box of saying I didn't time out. I didn't quit. Or sorry, I didn't quit. I ended up timing out. But yeah, like I said, they taped up my knee and I fell really hard, and it like just was shockwaves of pain throughout my leg. And just the limping got even worse and worse. But once I got through that first technical section, I fell again downhill, like just basically into a tree, and my knee slammed into the tree. And I started moving, and I put pressure down on my leg, and it didn't have stabbing pains. It was just like really hard, dull aches. And so I tried picking up the pace a little bit more, using the foot a little bit more rather than dragging it. And the next thing I knew, I was kind of mad at myself because I was like, oh crap, looks like I can finish this lap now. I was like a rabid animal for a period of time. I was straight up sprinting up the hills, trying to catch back up with Harvey and Teramici. And at one point I got far enough where I could see them off in the distance, and it just kind of, this wave came over me of like, crap. I'm going to have to be doing this for like another 6, 8, 12 hours. And I mean, luckily the knee, it hurt from time to time, but it could handle the technical trails somehow. I do not know how, but it worked out. So.
So as you watch these races unfold, especially as you get down to the last 2 to 3 people, there is a dialogue. It's either one's going faster than the other. We're helping each other. We're staying close to each other. We're pacing each other. What was evolving between you and Harvey in those sort of last 6 to 8 laps?
I mean, I didn't chat with him too much. He, especially towards the end, like on the road section to start each loop, he was faster than I was. I was limping going down the hill. And trying to be cautious coming back up until I got to the trail. And then maybe I would catch up with him. But a lot of times I was just set on being in my own little space, focusing on myself. I honestly didn't have too much communication with Harvey in those last hours. And then by the time we'd get to the line, I was just kind of mentally just overwhelmed. There's just a lot of stuff I was working through physically and just trying to keep up nutrition and everything. So I get to the line, I just be like almost like a zombie just waiting for it to start. So yeah, I didn't really chat with Harvey too much. There's a couple times where we tagged together and we'd tackle sections of the trail.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, go ahead, Chris.
Oh, I was just gonna say it definitely wasn't like us running together, you know, frolicking through the forest for hours on end. Until one of us, you know, decided to pee and the other person went on ahead by 10 seconds. So it wasn't like that. So
No. So let's talk a little bit about when we went from 3 down to 2 and Teramici ended up, you know, not making it back on the course on time. And for any of the viewers watching, that was a very, very emotional moment that they ended up capturing on video. You know, what did you see? What did you feel? How did you feel inside knowing it was now, you know, either you or Harvey were going to be assisting one another to the win?
Yeah, I mean, so we started the lap and he wasn't in sight. But again, I was kind of limping to start and was very slow to get out of the gate. So I stopped at the turn, you know, right at the road and watched him finish and just kind of collapse. And it looked emotional. But then I had to go on about my business and then finish the run for the hour. And I don't know if I really fully processed the implications of him dropping. I guess over the course of the next hour or two, it came to hit me that, you know, there really truly were only two of us left, that I would have at least the assist, which to me, it's just as important as the win. So being one of the final two, mm-hmm. was a pretty big deal. It was very gratifying to get to that point. So.
Yeah, I think that's something that's really different about this style of racing. And I'm glad you brought that up, which is, you know, you only get as far as that last lap of the person before you. So if you want to make a big effort, someone's got to make a big effort. You can't get to 85 unless someone runs 84. You can't get to 40 unless someone runs 39. That just sort of changes the dynamic, which is like, oh, wow, I felt good. Imagine if, you know, you decided that you were going to drop out at 72, well, then Harvey would add 73. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in some sense, there has to be a real gratefulness on the part of the person who does get the win, as much as anything, you know, for what the other did for them.
Yeah, and I do feel a bit bad for Harvey because, like, I mean, physically, my muscles felt fine, and he looked like he was just cruising as well. And it felt like it could have gone on for quite a while longer. We might have made it through the entire night. I had no sleep problems whatsoever. I got to the point where I wasn't even taking caffeine. I don't think towards the end of that day, certainly not that night before. And so I felt a little bad for stopping, but I could not imagine going with the stabbing knee pains were just, it was, every time I would stop and my body would cool down, they would pick back up, and I was just like, it's not worth it. It would have been nice to push a bit more to see how far Harvey could have really taken it. Because who knows, maybe he had 100 hours in him on this day. And you never know if that's something that's going to come around again. So.
Yeah. And I mean, Chris, you know, and, you know, if your knee, you know, if there was a turnaround during that race, or even if your knee wasn't the thing that was acting up. Now, I guess we could always say there could always be something that acted up. I mean, there has to be such a long period of time that, you know, there's a lot that has to go your way. I mean, there just is. But, you know, maybe you had 100 hours in you as well, too. Do you think about that since? Do you kind of fantasize about the next moment that you get to step at Biggs? Or do you say, hey, too soon, I just want to cuddle with my kids and I don't want to have this conversation?
So I can think of many other races that are much, much more enjoyable than kind of backyard format. I feel like I'm going to be guilt tripped into doing next year's Biggs. I'm assuming I'm going to make the USA team or whatever it is.
Oh yeah. No question.
It's like the top 15 or whatever. I have a pretty good sense that I'm stuck running Biggs next year. Mm-hmm. In which case, yeah, I'll probably get into the headspace of 100 hours is entirely doable. And so like I said, if it weren't my knee, I really think that was an outside possibility of getting to those triple digits last week, but just didn't happen that time around.
Yeah, you know, there were a lot of things that sort of went well. The weather was pretty good. You know, yes. It was cold at night, and that could affect you, but otherwise
Yeah, can you imagine rain on that, on the day course?
Oh.
There's no way you get even 70 hours, I don't think.
No, like the night before the race, it poured like nothing you've ever seen. Had that been 12 hours later, you know, you would be losing people left and right on that, because you would be falling as well as not being able to run. So yeah, so the weather did cooperate. Of course, we didn't have the Europeans there this year, so we don't know what would have happened if you know, Keith Russell was there, or John Stocker, or Johan, or any of the others who were pretty good at this format. You know, there's a lot of mechanics to it, I think, that people are learning as well. You know, how do you use your spare time? You know, did you, by the way, sleep at all? You know, nap for 5-10 minutes here and there?
Yes, absolutely. So like I had said, with Capital, I didn't sleep a single second, really. The first 2 days at Capital, I was 100% solo. So I kind of had to be responsible for everything, and napping was a risk.
Yeah.
But here at Biggs, you know, I had my crew chief looking after me, and we were able to get a lot of nap time, even if it was just a minute. There's some times where I wasn't sure if I had actually fallen asleep or not. Towards the end, there was definitely times where he was shaking me awake. You know, I'd missed the 3-minute bell and completely, and you know, he was looking out for me to make sure I got up the 2-minute bell. But I was just there were times where I probably got a solid 5 to 10 minutes of sleep. So yeah, cumulatively, there was multiple hours of sleep that I got throughout the race.
You feel like it helped you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Between that and having a better management of my caffeine intake, those two combined together really helped me stay kind of like on even ground throughout the race mentally. There's just good focus. There's rarely any times where I felt clouded and foggy.
So, yeah. Yeah, no, that's so important. And what about your knee now? Have you had it looked at? Do you have a really good team, a physiotherapist, a doctor that?
I haven't done anything. I'm considering having it looked at because it still hurts. The swelling is mostly down, but I'm just going to keep elevating it, popping anti-inflammatories, icing it on occasion, and we'll see what happens. But yeah, sometime next week, if it's still really problematic, I'll probably go get an MRI or something taken on it.
So before I end up losing you, let's just talk about that last lap and, you know, what happens, you know, how does one end up finishing at that point? And like, then how did you feel like when that happened?
I mean, mentally, I was totally alert. I was completely fine with my decision at that point. We had gone, I had gone much farther than I had anticipated given previous night's struggle with the knee. But when I got out on that final lap where I turned around, I walked all the way down to the bottom of the hill. Every single step, it was just searing pain in the knee. And I just couldn't imagine struggling through that hour after hour after hour, trying to get, you know, in under an hour. I think I might have been able to do it for a couple, and maybe, you know, best case scenario, I'd get into a groove and my knee would stop locking up, you know, between, you know, those few hour minutes where you're not exercising before the next loop starts. Maybe it wouldn't have cooled down so much, but I just, getting to that point, it just seemed like too much pain. So. And I honestly didn't know if I was causing real, like, structural damage to my knee at that point. So I decided to listen to my body, which is, you know, one of those tenets that my wife always gives me for racing and even just long runs. Listen to your body and make sure you take care of yourself. So.
So then you were good with ending then at that point. Like, at peace, feel good. Did an amazing job, and it's cool.
Yep. 100%.
And did you look forward to seeing Harvey? As he, you know, of course, he would end up going and doing the course and then coming back and realizing, hey, I just won this damn thing and I don't need to go out again. Were you looking forward to seeing his face of you know, success and joy?
Yeah. I mean, I really wish I could have been there around the turnaround where he would have, you know, had the realization that he's got it in the bag. He just has to walk jog in. That would have been really cool to somehow be out there. It was nice to see him come in and just have that sense of relief. He kind of washed over you. You don't have to go out again.
It's a wonderful thing at that moment, I think. Like, all right. Mm-hmm. The thing I also find just always amazing, it could be a marathon, a 100-miler, this race, you have people in there running, and then the minute they stop and it's over, they're like, I can barely walk. And you saw a lot of that. It's just so interesting how, to Dave's point, we can keep going until we can't. And then when we can't, we really can't. Yeah. And, you know, we had Matt Shepard who fell, I think it was like on lap 32, and he hit on his hip and he finished the lap but couldn't get back out, you know. But for the most part, that's not usually how you end up not finishing. You know, it's not the fall that does it. It's just whatever, it's fatigue or the time. So, you know, so as you think about now that you are at this very elite level, well, yeah, I know it's the same reaction John Stocker had. He's like, I never thought I was elite, but it really is quite amazing because in the world of endurance sports, you're really pushing everything you possibly could. You know, you're pushing limits of sleep, physical, nutrition, the mental, the emotional. There's, you know, there is very few other ways we can sort of simulate the strain that you put on yourself. So, so in that category, yeah, you know, like Navy SEAL kind of hell week you guys go through when you do this race. It's not that much easier. Really, you know, they always exploit the weakness in the Navy SEALs is exploiting sort of the escape. It's like, you can get to a warm coffee and a donut, just ring the bell. You know, it's like, hey, it's so easy to go to comfort. And I think the backyard winners put comfort out of their mind, right? Which is what you did. And that's not what you're seeking that day. You know, you're not seeking that. And so congrats on being able to do that. Do you have advice for people who are entering into this sport, not just ultra running, but into the backyard format? Anything you can pass along?
I mean, the biggest things for me are caffeine management and sleep management. If you're looking to go fairly long, you know, beyond 36 plus hours, there's gotta be some ability to get sleep in a form or another, and making sure you're comfortable with, you know, understanding how you're going to get that sleep. You know, having, you know, if it's a cot or a chair that you're laying in, you know what the blankets are that you're going to use, and are you going to use white noise and all this kind of stuff, and just kind of getting into that sense so that you know what to expect when you finish a lap, and like you're immediately there, like you've got everything lined up and ready to go, you're comfortable with it, and so you can get out and, you know, kind of pass out hopefully just as quickly as possible. I think that's really important, just kind of having that system to prepare for and to be comfortable with.
No, absolutely, those are excellent. Yeah, you know, if you got your sleep, if you're taking care of caffeine, your mind is taken care of, and you know, I'm sure you and I saw everybody out there get to a point, you know, except for, well, you and Harvey, where you guys end up, you know, making a choice and kind of giving into that escape. And then it's a lot of the time a mental decision, and it's clouded in fog and things. And so, Chris, I couldn't be any prouder of you. You've done incredible. You know, this is amazing. So I gotta ask now, you know, you've come off the biggest race of your life. You know, and I think it's so funny whenever we talk to, you know, Joe, whenever we talk to these athletes that do these extraordinary things, and we say, you know, you're on an elite level. I think that we seem to think the elite level is LeBron James of basketball, or, you know, the Sammy Sosa of baseball. But, you know, it's not. You are the one the world's best at this, right?
You mentioned Sammy Sosa, and like literally the other day I was thinking of that. Like, I feel like Sammy Sosa, like he broke the record, but it's still not good enough.
Yeah, of course. And I didn't even think about that, but, you know, being second to Mark McGuire and the record, on and so forth. Yeah, of course. But, you know, like, you know, what's next for a guy like you? You know, I mean, the world just opened up. I think it's so easy to kind of get caught up with getting on ultra sign up and signing up for something else because you don't want this feeling to go away, but you also don't appear to me to be that guy. And so what's next for a guy like you? What's your chasing tomorrow?
So, I mean, low-key tomorrow stuff is I've got a couple hundred milers I'm interested in for next year. I'm going to sign up. I signed up for Bighorn, so that's always been near the top of my list as one of those, you know, out west kind of rugged races. At the end of the day, though, it's always Barkley for me. It's been kind of my singular focus for the past couple of years, just trying to get my body into a position where I think I'm, you know, I should be able to do something well there. So don't apply until you're good enough to have something to back it up. And then the whole backyard thing for the most part for me has just been kind of figuring out what Barkley could feel like. So what is it like to go 60 hours without sleep? What are your nutrition strategies look like when you're running 2-3 times as far as you've done for your typical 100 milers? How do you need to change up your game for planning and preparing for that kind of event? So that's the big thing on my list. So whenever that happens, whether it's next year or 5 years from now, that's kind of the primary goal.
Yeah, that's a big list. That's great.
That's awesome. Chris, you know, take care of yourself. You know, I think, you know, I'm the guy who's probably been on the planet the longest of the three of us. I think, you know, being humble doesn't mean you're not great. And, you know, we can measure your performance very objectively. So, you know, you did accomplish an amazing feat last weekend. So congrats on that. And you can still be, you know, a good dad and a good person with great performances in life. It's a nice combination. So thanks for being on with us.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Take care.